Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome from Berlin, Germany. And my guest today is Wieland Hoban, and he is the chair of the Jewish Voice for a Just Peace in the Middle East, as it is translated from German to English. Thank you very much for being on my show, Wieland. And I wrote as the intro that the ongoing massacre in Gaza seems to bring out the worst in all the countries of the so-called free West. And we had an occurrence here in Germany, in Berlin, where you have invited people to a Congress, and it made headlines worldwide. It was among them was Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece and a politician who I was lucky enough to interview in 2015, and I really enjoyed it. We called it colonialism in the EU, the interview at that time. That was concerning Greece, mm-hmm. because Germany was treating Greece like a colonial state. Yeah, we were a colonial state, and it was not very nice. So in this case, again, we have to talk about what's going on in Germany. And I feel like I would like really to apologize again. I did that to CJ Hopkins because of what happened to him. And the same applies to you. But maybe you give us a short intro. Tell us what happened on this during this Congress that you tried to have to take place in Berlin, but you were not really successful because our police intervened and some people from the interior minister cursed them.
Yeah. Well, I should, before I go to the day of the Congress itself, I should add that in the several weeks in the run-up to the Congress, that there was already a kind of campaign against it in the media and also among politicians, especially in Berlin. There was a level of incitement and really just attacks against it that, you know, I haven't seen it with any sort of far-right event. You know, like one, I guess, sort of right-wing newspaper, Tagesspiegel, it seemed like every day they had some new story in which they were inveighing against the, you know, these anti-Semitic hordes who were going to descend on Berlin and, you know, create this shameful event of Israel hate. And it was quite hysterical. You know, this level of rhetorical escalation, and then also politicians in Berlin saying that this should be banned, and in fact, you know, that wouldn't have been legal. There were no legal grounds for a ban, and but it was clear that if they couldn't ban it, they could still find other ways to prevent it. One of these ways was by freezing our bank account, so freezing Jewish Voice's bank account, because our account was being used to gather the funds for it. I should add that several organizations were involved in organizing the Congress. We were only one of several, but we were the ones who gave our account for that purpose. And so the Berliner Sparkasse is a state-owned bank, so there's a direct connection to the state authorities, which presumably made it simpler to exert political pressure on it than would have been the case with some private bank. And so accordingly, our account was frozen. And a little after that, because we hadn't complied with some document requests in time, it was then also closed. And this was very clear that this wasn't just, you know, they hid behind some formalities, some bureaucracy, right? So they said, you know, we need to just regularly update our records, make sure we have the current information about our clients. And they asked for a number of documents they had never asked for before. And one of the most conspicuous of these was a list of all members with addresses. And
Okay.
this was really a request that, you know, it just seemed like directly from the police or from the, you know, intelligence service. This is not
Right.
something that an organization like ours would normally be asked for. And for us, it's an unacceptable demand. We would never give that list under any circumstances, especially considering that in the whole context of political pressure on Palestine activism, we've seen house raids, for example, you know, people getting a visit at 6 in the morning, then having their...
Even in your organization?
No, not yet. But I have to say, in the current atmosphere, I wouldn't be surprised. If one of our members were raided, I'm quite glad that I don't live in Berlin. At least the federal system places some obstacles in the path of the Berlin authorities in case they want to confiscate my computer or something. But you know, there are different ways to target an organization. One of them is bank account, and you know, cyber attacks are also a possibility. You know, it's pretty clear that in the last few months there have been cyber attacks on our website. It's unclear from where. Could be from Israel, or it could be within Germany. So in any case, in the run-up to the Congress, there were already these various attempts. We managed to circumvent the attempt with the account, because then one of the other organizations provided its account, and some of our members were able to pick up some of the slack for payments that needed to be made, such as the rent for the venue. And then even there, just 1 or 2 days before the conference was to begin, the police were putting pressure on the manager of the venue, and actually really a kind of blackmail, a kind of, it was like mafia methods, really. They were implying that maybe that, you know, his business could be over, basically, if he provided his venue for the Congress. They really intimidated him. And this was just another one of these ways in which they hoped to prevent it. But it started. And so that was already really a kind of victory for us, that it was even possible to start the Congress at all.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't think that it would be cut off so quickly, but in the end, it wasn't very surprising. But the explanations that were used were actually almost shocking, just in how tenuous and weak they are. Because they refer to laws, but they don't actually comply with these laws. So, for example, one of the central aspects of the state's case against the Congress is that a speaker was there, not in person, but in the form of a video recording, who had shortly before that been given a ban on appearing in Germany. You know, they call it an activity ban, Betätigungsverbot. And this
By
only
the way,
applies...
this Betätigungsverbot, the German expression, as far as I know, had been delivered only once, and that was to ISIS. So you
right?
have been put on the same level as ISIS. And I think you still have to explain a little bit what the Jewish Voice for Just Peace, there's something similar in the United States. I think you're also associated with that, but you might have to explain a little bit more what your organization is, because
sure.
It's a Jewish voice. It's just Jewish, I don't know, we would call them peaceniks or whatever, people who try to have peace in the Middle East, and that qualifies you for being, I mean, there was also, they founded an organization here in Berlin, which was called against anti-Semitic terrorism or something. All the politicians from the major party. This is, it's out in the, it's something between ridiculous and 1984, something in between. But please explain it a little and carry on. I didn't want to interrupt you, just to explain, because not everybody will know who you are and what happened in Berlin. Yeah,
of course. Of course. I'll say a few words about our organization, but first I'd just like to get back to this Congress, because I mean, there are a lot of legal details and pretexts, but really the central issue is that the police and by extension the Senate pretended essentially that this speaking ban applies to a video. but it only applies to someone being physically present on site. You know, this is a clear-cut legal fact, you know. And as it happens, one of the lawyers in the legal team assisting the Congress, she had a few years ago had a similar case, which she won, and there was a clear precedent, you know. So it only applies to physical presence, and the speaker was not physically present. So this ban has nothing to do with what was going on, you know. And in any case, the ban on him, yeah, was because of supposed incitement and anti-Semitism. And essentially then the excuse for extending the ban to the entire conference, so not just interrupting his speech, was that there was a danger that there could be further interventions from other people who had speaking bans. And as I've just said, the initial premise was null and void anyway, because he wasn't there. And so even if there had been more speakers with speaking bans, it would also have been irrelevant. So the whole thing from a legal perspective is a farce. And, you know, in the end, what we have just is that a Congress that was organized to send a very clear message that Germany is complicit in the Gaza genocide, this was prevented because this message has to be suppressed. Now, I'll say a few words about our organization. We were founded in 2003. That was a year after, in 2002, an umbrella group called European Jews for a Just Peace had been founded with members in several European countries. And initially a small number of Israeli and German Jews came together to found this group. Then in 2007, we got the status of a, you know, registered charitable organization. And we're not formally affiliated with Jewish Voice for Peace in the US, but, you know, we're comrades. So, you know, we know people from there, and we're in contact. But they're a very big organization. They've been around also for longer than we have, since the second half of the 90s. What's important in our name is that it's not just peace, but a just peace, because it's really about justice. Because I think a common idea of peace really is just a kind of submission, that the Palestinians will finally agree for their subjugation to be completely entrenched. You know, that's, a lot of people have the idea that essentially the problem is that the Palestinians won't just accept defeat. And so their idea of peace is about accepting this defeat. It's not about changing an unjust system, and it doesn't acknowledge a system of colonial oppression. So to us, it's very important to send that message and to say, you know, we can't just say to the Palestinians, you know, here are a few crumbs of territory, now behave. You know, it's very important to us that these are people who have been oppressed for, you know, 80 years almost, and that there can't be peace without justice. So that's, you know, that justice is crucial. And in a sense, it's more urgent because the peace will come after the justice. The justice is necessary for the peace. So that's central to our message about the situation in Israel-Palestine.
Yeah, that's a good time to have a break. We have to have two breaks for advertisements. So this is the first one. And we get back a little bit into the history, because I'd like to, from what you said, I'd like to know from you in a very concise way how you see the conflict. And I think it's important to understand. I've been at your 20th anniversary, and I really enjoyed that festivity. It was like a a stream of cool, fresh air to me, that to see that there are people, you were standing on the stage with people from Palestine, and it was in a cultural center in Germany, which is run by people with a background in from migration. A lot of them from, there were some from Palestine, from Arab countries. Some of them were gay. So it was like, you know, it was seeing that it was possible to be together. Mm-hmm. That looked like the future to me that I'd like to see. And you are in trouble. Something is very wrong. But first, for the ads, we come back.
The Lights is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. Thelightpaper.co.uk.
Ladies and gentlemen,
today's news talk.
News and information.
TNT Radio.
Yeah, and back with Wieland Tobin from the Jewish Voice for Just Peace in the Middle East. He gave an outlook about what happened. I think we have to say again, it was the person who was banned to come through as a streaming video was Yanis Varoufakis. And you also had I think it's the rector of the Glasgow University, Ghassan Abu Sitar, who is a doctor and had worked in Gaza. He came up with experience. He wanted to talk about that. And there was also historian Salman Abu Sitar. No, oh, that is an 88-year-old historian. He also was a speaker. So you had very distinguished guests. And the same applied really when I was there at the 20th anniversary. And it was so fascinating because you could see, you immediately were able to get in contact with these people with background from the Middle East. And it was, you were talking on eye level, and they were under pressure too. Their funding has been cut off now. And they stood, they said, no, we know these people now, and we want to work together with them. So in effect, you could say you achieved what would be necessary as the first step to come to a real peace. You were respected by these people. You respect them. This is why this happens. And miraculously, when this kind of communication takes place, it's possible to talk. It's possible to collaborate. So that is a good, it gives one ray of hope how things could be handled. But I'd like, because it was, you know, I also enjoyed it because it was truly dissident. It was not something that was mainstream information or something you could hear on a talk show in Germany, everything. And it was high level from the intellectual side, high level information. So please give us a rough outline about how you see the situation, how these Jewish people, it's only Jewish people. I'd like to become a member of that organization. It's not possible because I'm not a Jew, but these are people who have a background in humanistic philosophy. And so what is your take on the whole thing to talk about that?
Take on the Middle East, you mean, or also looking at
on Gaza, the situation like with the Palestinians, because there was an outline, you know, we hear a lot about it started with October 7th now. This it was a massacre for sure. I mean, nobody can be happy about that. That is a definite thing that it was an attack, but it's not an unprovoked attack. There's a pre-story to that. And if you want to get into a situation where it's possible to find a solution, it has to take into account what happened before, so both sides know what they are talking about. And I would like to hear that from you now.
Well, of course, the 7th of October was a symptom. It wasn't the cause. And this is a message that's difficult to get across in the German mainstream. In the population, it's a bit different. You know, the majority of ordinary Germans, when asked by pollsters, say that they're against what Israel is doing in Gaza. And, you know, many just ordinary people maybe don't follow it very closely, but they are aware that the Palestinians have been wronged, you know, and that maybe their reasons for committing acts of violence are not simply because they're violent terrorists, but because actually they are responding to oppression. But the German establishment that tries to obscure this, you know, they try to prevent an awareness of the history and also history in general, because if you look at any anti-colonial struggle, you know, whether it's Algeria or Vietnam or Haiti, you know, there was always violence, and this violence was not always just. And, you know, the Native Americans, they killed settler families as well. You know, we wouldn't justify this today. We wouldn't say, yes, it was good that they did that, but we would say they were resisting genocide. They were defending themselves. But because in Germany, everything before the 7th of October was not considered violence towards Palestinians, accordingly, something like the 7th of October was not considered a response. This was to them, so it was presented as an unprovoked attack. And then when you had things being said like, you know, the most deadly day for Jews since the Holocaust, this just put completely the wrong framing on it. And or when people called it a pogrom, even, you know, pogroms are perpetrated by a majority against an oppressed minority. Okay, and in Israel, we have a Jewish majority that clearly has more power than the rest of the population. And Israel has nuclear weapons. It's not some, you know, some weak. To draw a parallel between the majority Israeli population and Jews persecuted during the Holocaust is obscene. And this, of course, has the effect of completely dehumanizing the Palestinians. And to an extent, those parts of the German mainstream that support this narrative are, you might say, foisting their Holocaust guilt onto the Palestinians. They're saying that really the Palestinians are the Nazis now. They're the anti-Semites. They're the ones who want to kill Jews. We've learned our lessons. You know, we have atoned, we've paid reparations, we've said that, you know, we did terrible things. But all these Palestinians and Muslims and Arabs, you know, they still want to kill Jews. So they take it completely out of its historical context. And, you know, we could go back to the Nakba of 1948, or, well, it actually started at the end of 1947. Mm-hmm. The first expulsions of Palestinians and massacres in villages already began in December 1947. And, you know, by the time the Nakba was over the course of 1948, 531 villages had been destroyed. But still, much of this is presented as self-defense by the German mainstream. And actually, even now in Berlin schools, there is a propaganda booklet being distributed, which, well, it's a revisionist pamphlet, basically, explaining that there weren't really expulsions. You know, there were some conflicts and Arab leaders told Palestinians to leave. So really, it's actually now got to the point where Israeli state propaganda is being distributed in Germany to students. And I don't think it'll be very successful, because many of these students will come actually from Arab and Palestinian families who will know what happened. But the very idea of it is outrageous, you know. And okay, as I said, we could go back to 1947, or we could go back to 1917. the year of the Balfour Declaration, when the British Empire, in its last phase, decided to give Palestine to the Jews for a Jewish state, as the Ottoman Empire came to an end and Great Britain took over control of Palestine, the Mandate of Palestine. And there's a whole really historical narrative that needs to be mainstreamed in Germany, which is that Israel as a state, you know, a Jewish state, I'm not talking about just Jews living in self-determination, whatever, culturally, religiously, but an actual Jewish nation state was from the start something that was supported by the British Empire as a colonial enterprise, as an extension of Western power in the Middle East. And that was precisely how it was also marketed to them by Theodor Herzl, the founder of political Zionism.
Yes, you know, I think that is a very important point, because there's some, in a way, I think it would be fair to say that there's some British but also European responsibility. This attitude of racism and colonialism is part of this backstory. It's not the only the Jews. It is where the Jews came from. It's like a diffusion from an ideology that was prevalent in Europe into that movement, and it's still more active than in many other cases. In Germany, we have a very difficult case also, because now there are a lot of people who think they're on the moral high ground if they defend Israel. To defend Israel as defending the Jews, it's a strange mix. It's not very not very elaborated in terms of thinking, but it's very strong. I mean, it's having a judgment without knowing really too much about it. But I think you have to explain that. So you did it very well. I just wanted to interrupt and say it's not the Israelis or the Jews. We have a European responsibility, and this is something that I feel why we have to speak up in terms of we have to take care for both sides. That's kind of a German obligation, that we have an obligation towards the Jews, definitely, I think, but also to have learned the lesson correctly. And the lesson is no racism, no colonialism. Huh?
Well, absolutely. And we mustn't forget that the Nakba, so the period of expulsions and massacres against Palestinians, which resulted in the displacement of 750,000 of them, that this was also a consequence of the Holocaust, because without the Holocaust, the number of Jews leaving Europe would have been far, far smaller. Many of the Jews who ultimately ended up in Palestine, or in Israel after the foundation of Israel, they didn't go there because they were ideological Zionists. They went there simply because there was nowhere left to go. And that's not only because of the persecution by the Nazis and their allies, but then also the fact that other countries closed their doors to them. Some emigrated, of course, to the USA, to Australia, to the UK, etc. But at a certain point, they didn't want any more refugees. And then the only place left to go was Palestine. Because there, the Zionist movement needed numbers. They really needed Jews if they wanted to have a Jewish state. And to them, it was very important to have people coming there. And, you know, Herzl once said, around the end of the 19th century, he said referring to the Zionist movement, he said that the anti-Semites will be our closest allies because they have a common interest, namely to get Jews out of Europe. And so for me, it's important to emphasize that Zionism is very much based on the logic of anti-Semitism, namely that Jews and non-Jews should not be living together. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Because in Germany, many people can only see things through the lens of the Holocaust, they just see this logic that Jews were persecuted, and therefore, after the Holocaust, a Jewish state had to be founded. But, you know, Theodor Herzl wrote his book, The Jewish State, in 1896. So this was already happening for decades. And it was a decision that had always, that was made in full awareness that there were people living in Palestine. And of course, at first, Herzl wasn't particularly attached to any particular location. You know, he didn't think of Palestine first. There were different countries that were discussed: Uganda, Alaska, Madagascar, Argentina. He just needed a territory. So he was speaking to the Western powers that controlled these territories. And then it came to be Great Britain and Palestine. And he realized also that he would get more allies among Jews with that, because there were those who were very attached to the idea of, you know, the historical homeland, the Holy Land, which he wasn't himself personally attached to at all. He was very much a Western European, assimilated Jew who had no attachment really to Jewish history, religion, culture. But he was a pragmatist, so when he saw that this was attractive to others to join the movement, then and that it corresponded also to the interests of Great Britain, then that was pursued. So we must never forget this imperial realpolitik also, and that's something that was then taken over by the USA in the late 60s, especially after the Six-Day War had shown that that Israel had great military prowess compared to the countries around it. They'd managed to finish off Egypt, assisted by Syria and Jordan, in a very short time. And then America realized that they had to have this country as its extension, the way that Great Britain had wanted it as its own extension, but had failed because the Zionists had ideas of their own, and Great Britain was no longer powerful enough to control them. So that's also another thing we have to remember when there's all this talk of guilt and responsibility behind support for Israel today. You know, that's, to an extent, that's a cover story. Because, sure, if you talk to ordinary people in the population, you know, there are those who still do feel a strong collective guilt, even though they personally had nothing to do with the Nazi atrocities. But they may feel some of this, but the rationale guiding the state is material. It's because they also want to have access to this Western ally, and arms sales to Israel have increased tenfold from Germany since last year. So this is, you know, this is imperialist business as usual. And already in the 50s, you know, the first post-war Chancellor of Germany, Konrad Adenauer, he realized that the most important shortcut to rehabilitating Germany after the defeat in the Second World War, and this the pariah status also that Germany had because there was such disgust at the Holocaust as the information came out, he saw the fast route to rehabilitation was to be on good terms with Israel. So already in the 1950s, the Germans were selling a lot of weapons to Israel.
Right.
And that's always been the case. So every time when people talk about, yes, you know, our historical responsibility towards Israel, or then when you get the Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck talking about his grandfather's generation, you know, who cares about his grandfather? Firstly, that, you know, the Palestinians aren't to blame for his grandfather. And secondly, you know, his grandfather doesn't matter when it comes to arms sales and geopolitics. So we shouldn't fall for this moral marketing that they do.
Yeah, it's a tool in a way that is quite powerful. And so if you have this, let's say, in the back of your head that there's the possibility, I think it's quite natural that somebody tries to use it. But that should be discussed in a way that we understand what's going on, because the projection of future actions must be that they are reasonable, and how can we achieve a peaceful situation. And that's also something, because it's I had Nirit Sommerfeld interviewed about 2 or 3 months ago, and she said for her it was devastating, because she felt everything that she ever worked for, and she's with you in this organization, and she's a very warm-hearted person, I can say that. And it was destructive. There was some hopes, I could say the same that I think we can say about you and about all the people in the Jewish Voice for Peace, that you have a lot of respect within the Arab community. They notice what you're doing. They notice that you are on eye level contact, which is very, very different. It's also now the strange thing in Germany that Germans try to be like super morally on the Jewish side. That is another question that I would have. What is wrong? What is wrong with this whole picture? How to deconstruct it in a way that it can be a guidepost, how to handle this. But for her, she said she felt everything, it was all wrecked. The whole work that she's done was wrecked. And she didn't know if there was any hope to resurrect it. So I'd like to ask the same to you. What is your, is there a way to proceed when we see what is going on? And if there is, what are the steps that are important for that? Because they might be connected to having a correct analysis, because before we can proceed, what we should do, we should talk about what is the status that the status that we have before we can talk what should happen afterwards, because if the analysis is strong, nothing will work on the other way.
Yeah. That's right. You know, we all have different battles to fight. You know, we know Israeli comrades who are on the ground there, who are trying to demonstrate against this ultra right wing society, and who are having a very hard time of it, and who also say to us, look, you know, we're not going to make the change. We can't do it really from within. You know, they're going to
keep
fighting.
I have to interrupt you. I'm sorry. I missed the time. We have to do another round of advertisements. Sorry for that. Let's get back to this idea, what we can do in the future after the ads. Yeah.
Okay.
It's been said that when someone you love has Parkinson's, you have Parkinson's. The truth is, Parkinson's disease doesn't just affect the diagnosed. It affects everyone who supports and helps care for them. Worldwide, over 10 million people are living with Parkinson's, a neurological disease that affects movement. And with so many places to search for information, it can be difficult to know where to begin. The Parkinson's Foundation has answers. Answers for everyone in the fight. We can help you understand the disease, help you find expert care, give you tips for living a better life, share the latest research, help you find local support, and there's a free helpline you can call. Find your answers and join us in the fight against Parkinson's. To learn more, please go to parkinson.org or call 1-800-4PD-INFO. The Parkinson's Foundation. Better lives together.
Even the thought of dementia can feel scary. It's why we put off getting help, even though we've noticed changes in our thinking or memory. But an early diagnosis can change everything, giving you medical help and a support system around you to help you live better. Start with Dementia Australia's online checklist, because the sooner you know, the more you can do.
You're listening to Dirk Pullman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Yes, and back with my guest, Wieland Hoban. I'm sorry I had interrupted you. That was not very polite, but the floor is yours now. So continue with the outlook.
Yeah, so the question was about going forward. And as I was saying, you know, depending on where we are, we have different battles to wage, because this is an international issue. It's not just about Israel, Palestine itself. And so the activists in Israel who are up against enormous obstacles they try to do what they can, but they also say there has to be pressure from the outside, because our power, you know, within Israel, with such a small minority now, that it's very difficult for us to have an effect. And in Germany, we see now how actually the ban on the Congress has gained, I think, far more attention worldwide for the Congress than it would have if it had just been allowed to go ahead. Because the whole world now has seen what Germany is capable of and what it's willing to do in order to silence those who would accuse it of complicity in genocide. And so in that sense, you know, it's like finding the spot that hurts. And this is really the spot that hurts, where you provoke this kind of backlash from the state. And I should add, maybe as an aside, that not all cities are like Berlin in this regard. Berlin is particularly oppressive, and also the Berlin authorities show more disregard for the law, I would say, than in some other cities. But nonetheless, Germany has really shown the world now that it's willing to use authoritarian measures to stifle this message. And the message is very clearly not only that there is a genocide happening in Gaza, but that Germany is complicit in it. So, you know, this is the struggle, one of the struggles that we have to fight here now. It's against the German state, and also against, you know, the hegemonic German media, which, although they occasionally allow in some critical voices here and there in articles, there's still a dominant line that Israel shouldn't be questioned too much, and that it's still a kind of controversial outsider position if someone does. And, you know, people are still losing their jobs for speaking out for Palestine, getting cancelled. And here again, Germany is increasingly torpedoing its own reputation by disinviting people like Nancy Fraser, or, well, kind of semi-canceling Masha Gessen also. You know, these are ways in which Germany is just showing the world that it's actually not on the same level of awareness, and that there's this desperation to control the narrative. And the more people become aware of what is true, and also the more people want to speak out, the more desperate the state and institutions, not just state institutions, also in the culture sector, the more they try to stifle that dissent. So in that sense, I don't see it as a time of futility. I see it as a time when the battles are clearer than ever, actually. And it's a time when also it's more difficult, and where there's more resistance, and where also the state tries to distract us and waste our time by then coming up with some charges, criminal charges, because someone chanted a particular slogan at a demonstration. These ridiculous things. But instead of thinking this is all preventing us from carrying out activism, I think one can also see this simply as one of the things that is part of the struggle, and that by fighting the criminalization of slogans and of activism, by extension, that we are also fighting the state's unquestioning support for Israel, and that the more the level of discourse and consciousness can be advanced, the higher the likelihood is that something somehow could change. Of course, change is you know, not an easy process. And although we have a kind of democracy in Europe, we still, you know, the details of the democracy are limited. We can choose which parties to vote for, but there's no guarantee that those parties will do the things that we want. And
so, of course,
many people say, okay, what's the point of demonstrations? What's the point of petitions and all these things? But, you know, in history, changes, they've always come about at the end of a long process with, sure, maybe certain key events that were turning points, but always with a long process. You know, over decades, the fight against apartheid in South Africa took decades and was a combination of different levels also, you know, of resistance within South Africa and of solidarity also between white and black South Africans and the international boycott movement as well. Mm. Boycott is something that I think is also very important. Boycott and sanctions and divestment, or BDS as it's known for short. Because I think many people don't realize just how much support Israel receives from the West. So if one thinks, okay, how could one pressure Israel, you know, to change its course, then it's not so much a question of applying new methods of pressure as simply of taking back forms of support and actually exceptional treatment that shouldn't be there, like all sorts of you know, EU partnership deals, you know, in culture, education, commerce, special conditions for Israel, which is not in the EU, obviously, but which in some contexts is treated almost as a member state. So there
yes,
are...
I found it very interesting. I did quite a lot of research in the cooperation of South Africa and Israel with the nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And
that's
you could
right.
see there that... you know, there were Jewish people in South Africa who had the idea that being Jewish means that you're never on the side of the oppressor. You're always on the side of the oppressed. That's the historic context that they had. And then there were people who had the chance to be part of the ruling class or even ruling race and being on top, and they connected to on state level to the power. So there you could see that being on the Israeli state side or being Jewish is not exactly the same. It is a different perspective. If you go for the state power and with the logic of the state power, or if you are, if you come from the perspective that the blacks are oppressed in the same way that your population has been oppressed for such a long time, and then it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. But I think that's one of the core things that I understood, that the, let's say, you could call it the class situation, you could call it the social situation, you have to take that into account, because it's not a simple thing. It's not not one-dimensional. But I would like to, because we have about 7 minutes left now, I just read from Michael Hudson, he described that he was with Professor Khan when they were considering how to fight the war in Vietnam. And they wanted to cut up Vietnam into little villages, and in between you could prevent the people from moving. And he said, it's the same that I see with West Bank and Gaza now. And he said, and I don't know if that's true, he said there are plans already to get the population out. And there are people from real estate who think about selling Gaza to make a nice sea place, having high cost villages there.
That's
so right. What is your outlook? What is your outlook for the future? And there, what do we have to know again to have a correct analysis how to proceed? You were talking about boycott, divestment, sanctions. I think that is very important that it's possible to talk about that. In Germany, it immediately qualifies you now as an anti-Semite. And here again is the difference between Jewish. Yeah, I'm definitely that you are allowed to be Jewish in every term and on a cultured level. It doesn't mean that you have to oppress Gaza. It's not the same. It's an insult also to Jewishness, mm-hmm. I would say, to argue in that way. What is your take on the future, and what is planned there? What is the plan of the government?
Well, these plans for expulsion and ethnic cleansing are nothing new. And, you know, we see now that the majority, over half of the original population of Gaza have been concentrated in the south around Rafah. And, you know, there are Israeli politicians who want them to be driven across the border to Egypt. This is not something that the Egyptian regime is particularly keen on, but certainly, you know, Sisi has shown that he is willing to do the bidding of the West for the right price. And there are also more than a few people who are already talking about reestablishing settlements in Gaza, and people offering real estate. And the trouble is that from the Western imperialist position, the desirable outcome is for the kind of puppet statelet model that you see in the West Bank to be extended to Gaza as well, because the so-called Palestinian Authority works for the occupation. It's basically just an extension of the occupation, outsourcing some of Israel's dirty work to the Palestinians. And the US has said that they would like to see an extension of the Palestinian Authority to Gaza. And then this would put an end to this troublesome pocket of resistance that you had in Gaza the whole time since Hamas was elected in 2006. And this, of course, is a way to again entrench the subjugation of Palestinians. And this is not what most Palestinians would want, because this is not a self-determination. And you know, if you, for example, okay, there is one political figure, Marwan Barghouti, who is considered by many to be this, you know, great leadership figure. He's been in prison for a couple of decades and will probably never be let out by Israel, because the last thing that they need is a strong leader. They want to divide and rule. They don't want to unify. But what the Palestinians need is precisely that. It's unity, bringing together all factions and being stronger because they're united. But as long as it's in the West's interest for the Palestinians to be weak and divided, because that's what Israel wants, that's not going to happen. So the only way for Palestinians to have better prospects than simply this subaltern existence is if Israel is pressured to allow some kind of unity that is not based on having a puppet regime. And how that is to be achieved is very difficult to say, but I do think that although America is very much invested in Israel being powerful in the Middle East, it's perfectly happy to have less headaches with Israel that are created by Israel's violent behavior. And so I think if Israel could be pressured into allowing greater Palestinian unity and participation, then I think that maybe the US could accept that.
Wieland, I have to cut you off. We have 10 seconds to go. Thank you very much for this talk. And I promise to have you back on here to talk a little more. Bye.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.